2.1 For as long as he could remember, Ferguson had been looking at the drawing of the girl on the White Rock bottle. That was the brand of seltzer his mother bought on her twice-weekly trips to the A&P. And since his father was a firm believer in the virtues of seltzer water, there had always been a bottle of White Rock sitting on the table at dinner. Ferguson had therefore studied the girl hundreds of times, keeping the bottle near him in order to look at the black-and-white image of her half-naked body on the label. That enticing, serenely elegant girl with the small bare breasts and the white loincloth draped around her hips, falling open to reveal the entire length of her right leg, the foregrounded leg that was curled under her as she leaned forward on her hands and knees and gazed into a pool of water from her perch on the jutting rock, which fittingly bore the words White Rock. And the curious, altogether unlikely thing about the girl was that two diaphanous wings were protruding from her back, which meant that she was more than human, a goddess or an enchanted being of some sort. And because her limbs were so slender, and she gave the impression of being so small, she still qualified as a girl and not yet a full-grown woman, regardless of her breasts, which were the tiny, budding breasts of a 12- or 13-year-old. And with her neatly pinned-up hair, exposing the bare, luminous skin of her neck and shoulders, she was just the kind of girl a boy could entertain serious thoughts about. And when that boy turned a little older, say 12 or 13, the White Rock girl could easily evolve into a full-blown erotic charm, a summons to a world of fleshly passion and fully awakened desires. And once that happened to Ferguson, he made sure that his parents weren't looking at him when he looked at the bottle. There was also the kneeling Indian girl on the box of Land O'Lakes butter, the adolescent beauty with her long black braids and the two colorful feathers sticking out of her beaded headband. But the problem with this potential rival to the White Rock nymph was that she was fully clothed, which greatly lessened her allure, not to speak of the further problem of her elbows, which were thrust out stiffly from her sides because she was holding up a box of Land O'Lakes butter, identical to the one sitting in front of Ferguson, the same box but smaller, with the same picture of the Indian girl holding up another smaller box of Land O'Lakes butter, which was an intriguing if perplexing notion, Ferguson felt, an infinite regress of ever-shrinking Indian girls holding up ever-shrinking boxes of butter, which was similar to the effect produced by the Quaker Oats box, with the smiling Quaker in the black hat receding to some distant vanishing point beyond the grasp of human vision, a world inside a world which was inside another world which was inside another world which was inside another world until the world had been reduced to the size of a single atom and yet was still somehow managing to grow smaller. Interesting in its way, but hardly the stuff to inspire dreams, so the Indian butter maiden continued to run a distant second to the White Rock princess. Not long after he turned 12, however, Ferguson was let in on a secret. He'd gone down the block to visit his friend Bobby George, and as the two boys sat in the kitchen eating tuna fish sandwiches, in walked Bobby's 14-year-old brother Carl, a tall, chunky fellow with a good head for math and a face spotted with pimples, who sometimes bullied his younger brother and sometimes talked to him as an almost equal. But on that rainy Saturday afternoon in mid-March, the unpredictable Carl was in a generous mood, and as the boys sat at the table chewing their sandwiches and drinking their milk, he told them that he had made an astonishing discovery. Without mentioning what the discovery was, he opened the refrigerator and pulled out a box of Land O'Lakes butter, extracted a pair of scissors and a roll of scotch tape from a drawer by the sink, and then carried the three items over to the table. "Look at this," he said, and the two boys watched as he cut apart the six-paneled box and set aside the two large panels with the picture of the Indian girl on them. He cut into one of the pictures, removing the girl's knees and the bare skin just above the knees, which were sticking out from under the edge of her skirt, and then taped the knees over the butter box in the other picture, and lo and behold, the knees had been turned into breasts, a pair of large, naked breasts, each one with a red dot in the center of it that for all the world could have passed as a perfectly drawn nipple. The prim Lakota squaw had been transformed into a luscious sex pot, and as Carl grinned and Bobby squealed with laughter, Ferguson looked on without making a sound. What a clever bit of business, he thought. A few swipes from the scissors, a single strip of transparent tape, and the butter girl had been undressed. There were photographs of naked women in National Geographic, a magazine Bobby's parents subscribed to, and for some reason never threw away. And every so often during the spring of 1959, Ferguson and Bobby would come home from school and head straight for the George's garage, where they would comb through stacks of the yellow magazines searching for images of bare-breasted women, anthropological specimens from primitive tribes in Africa and South America, the black-skinned and brown-skinned women from warm-weather places who walked around with little or no clothing on their bodies and weren't ashamed to be seen like that, who displayed their breasts with the same indifference an American woman would feel in exposing her hands or ears. The photographs were distinctly unerotic, and except for a rare young beauty who popped up in every seventh or tenth issue, most of the women were not attractive to Ferguson's eyes. But still, it was exciting and instructive to look at those pictures, which, if nothing else, demonstrated the infinite variety of the female form, in particular the multitudinous differences to be found in the size and shape of breasts, from the large to the small and everything in between, from buoyant, surging breasts to flattened, sagging breasts, from proud breasts to defeated breasts, from symmetrical breasts to oddly matched breasts, from laughing breasts to crying breasts, from the thinned-out dugs of ancient crones to the bulging enormities of nursing mothers. Bobby snickered a lot during these foraging expeditions through the pages of National Geographic, laughing to cover up the embarrassment he felt for wanting to look at what he called dirty pictures. But Ferguson never thought of the pictures as dirty, and he never felt embarrassed by his desire to look at them. Breasts were important because they were the most prominent and visible feature that distinguished women from men. And women were a subject of great interest to him now, for even if he was still just a prepubescent boy of 12, enough was stirring inside him for Ferguson to know that the days of his boyhood were numbered. Circumstances had changed. The warehouse robbery of November 1955, followed by the car crash of February 1956, had removed both of Ferguson's uncles from the family circle. The disgraced Uncle Arnold now lived in far-off California. The deceased Uncle Lou had left this earth for good, and Three Brothers' homeworld was no more. For the better part of a year, his father had struggled to keep the business going, but the police never managed to recover the stolen appliances. And because he had forfeited his claim to the insurance money by refusing to press charges against his brother, the losses incurred by this act of mercy were too great to be overcome. Rather than go further into debt, he paid off the emergency loan from the bank with help from Ferguson's grandfather and sold out, unburdening himself of the building, the warehouse, and whatever stock remained, fleeing the ghosts of his brothers and the ruined enterprise that had been his life for more than 20 years. The building was still there, of course, standing in its old spot on Springfield Avenue, but now it was called Newman's Discount Furniture. Ferguson's father returned his father-in-law's loan with proceeds from the sale and then opened up a new, significantly smaller store in Montclair, Stanley's TV and Radio. From Ferguson's point of view, this was a much better arrangement than the old one, for his father's new business happened to be on the same block as Roseland Photo, and now it was possible for him to drop in on either one of his parents any time he wished. Stanley's TV and Radio was cramped, yes, but it had a nice, cozy feel to it, and Ferguson enjoyed visiting his father there after school. Sitting down beside him at his workbench in the back room, as his father repaired televisions, radios, and all manner of other things as well, taking apart and then putting back together dysfunctional toasters, fans, air conditioners, lamps, record players, blenders, electric juicers, and vacuum cleaners. For word had quickly spread that Ferguson's father was a man who could fix anything. And as the young clerk, Mike Antonelli, stood in the front room of the shop, selling radios and televisions to Montclair residents, Stanley Ferguson spent most of his time in the back, tinkering in silence, patiently dissecting broken machines in order to make them work again. Ferguson understood that something in his father had been crushed by Arnold's betrayal, that this reduced incarnation of his former business represented a profound personal defeat for him, and yet something in him had also changed for the better, and the principal beneficiaries of that change were his wife and son. Ferguson's parents argued far less than they had before. The tension in the household had dissipated, in fact, often seemed to have disappeared altogether, and Ferguson found it reassuring that his mother and father now had lunch together every day, just the two of them in their corner booth at Al's Diner, and again, in a variety of different ways, and yet always in the same way, Ferguson's mother would make remarks to him that essentially meant this: "Your father is a good man, Archie, the best man anywhere." A good man, and a still largely silent man, but now that he had given up his old dream of becoming the next Rockefeller, Ferguson felt more comfortable in his presence. They could talk a little now, and most of the time Ferguson felt reasonably certain that his father was listening to him. And even when they didn't talk, Ferguson took pleasure in sitting beside his father at the workbench after school, doing his homework at one end of the table, as his father went about his business at the other, slowly taking apart yet another damaged machine and putting it back together. Money was less plentiful than it had been in the days of Three Brothers' home world. Instead of two cars, Ferguson's parents now owned one car, his mother's 1954 powder blue Pontiac, and a red Chevrolet delivery van with the name of his father's business printed on each of the side doors. In the past, his parents had sometimes gone away together on weekend excursions, mostly to the Catskills for a couple of days of tennis and dancing at Grossinger's or the Concord, but they had stopped doing that after Stanley's TV and radio opened in 1957. In 1958, when Ferguson was in need of a new baseball glove, his father drove him all the way to Sam Brownstein's store in downtown Newark to buy one at cost, instead of giving him the money to buy the same glove at Gallagher's, the sporting goods shop in Montclair. The difference amounted to $12.50, and even $20 as opposed to $32.50. Not a large difference in the grand scheme of things, but a crucial savings nevertheless, enough to alert Ferguson to the fact that life had changed, and that from now on he would have to think carefully before he asked his parents for anything beyond what was strictly essential. Not long after that, Cassie Burton stopped working for them, and in much the same way that his mother and Aunt Mildred had wept in each other's arms at the airport in 1952, Cassie and his mother both wept on the morning Cassie was told the family could no longer afford to keep her. Yesterday it had been steaks, today it was hamburgers. The family had slipped a notch or two, but who in his right mind would lose any sleep over a little belt tightening? A book from the public library was the same book you bought in a store. Tennis was still tennis, whether you played at the municipal courts or a private club, and steaks and hamburgers were cut from the same cow. And even if steaks were supposed to represent the pinnacle of the good life, the truth was that Ferguson had always loved hamburgers, especially with ketchup on them, which was the same ketchup he had once smeared over the plump, medium-rare sirloins his father had liked so much. Sunday was still the best day of the week, particularly when it was a Sunday that didn't include visits to or from other people, a day that Ferguson could spend alone with his parents, and now that he was bigger and stronger and had turned into an agile, sports-crazed 12-year-old, he relished the morning tennis matches with his parents, the singles matches with his father, the two-against-one matches between mother, son, and husband-father, the doubles matches that paired him with his father against Sam Brownstein and his younger son. And after tennis, there was lunch at Al's Diner, along with the inevitable chocolate milkshake. And after lunch, there were the movies. And after the movies, there was Chinese food at the Green Dragon in Glen Ridge, or fried chicken at the Little House in Millburn, or hot open turkey sandwiches at Pal's Cabin in West Orange, or pot roast and cheese blintzes at the Claremont Diner in Montclair, the crowded, inexpensive dining spots of the New Jersey suburbs, noisy and unsophisticated perhaps, but the food was good, and it was Sunday night, and the three of them were together. And even if Ferguson was starting to pull away from his parents by then, that one day a week helped maintain the illusion that the gods could be merciful when they chose to be. Aunt Mildred and Uncle Henry had failed to produce the Adler cousin he had longed for as a small boy. The reasons were unknown to him, whether sterility or infertility, or a conscious refusal to add to the world's population. But in spite of Ferguson's disappointment, the no-cousin vacuum on the West Coast had ultimately worked to his advantage. Aunt Mildred might not have been close to her sister, but with no children of her own, and with no other nephews or nieces anywhere in sight, whatever maternal impulses she had in her were showered upon her one and only Archie. After her removal to California when Ferguson was 5, she and Uncle Henry had returned to New York several times for extended summer visits, and even when she was back in Berkeley during the rest of the year, she kept in touch with her nephew by writing letters and occasionally calling him on the phone. Ferguson understood that there was something glacial about his aunt, that she could be harsh and opinionated and even rude with other people. But with him, her one and only Archie, she was another person, full of praise and good humor and curiosity about what her boy was doing and thinking and reading. From his earliest childhood, she had been in the habit of buying him gifts, an abundance of gifts that had usually come in the form of books and records. And now that he was older and his mental capacities had increased, the number of books and records she shipped to him from California had also increased. Perhaps she didn't trust his mother and father to give him the proper intellectual guidance. Perhaps she thought his parents were a couple of uneducated bourgeois nobodies. Perhaps she believed it was her duty to rescue Ferguson from the wasteland of ignorance he dwelled in, thinking that she and she alone could offer him the help necessary to scale the exalted slopes of enlightenment. It was no doubt possible that she was, as he had once overheard his father say to his mother, an intellectual snob, but there was no arguing against the fact that, snob or not, she was a genuine intellectual, a person of vast erudition who earned her living as a university professor, and the works she exposed her nephew to were indeed a great blessing to him. No other boy in his circle of acquaintances had read what he had read, and because Aunt Mildred chose carefully for him, just as she had chosen carefully for her sister during the period of her confinement 13 years earlier, Ferguson read the book she sent to him with an avidity that resembled physical hunger. For his aunt understood what books would satisfy the cravings of a rapidly developing boy as he moved from 6 years old to 8 years old, from 8 years old to 10 years old, from 10 years old to 12 years old, and beyond that, to the end of high school. Fairy tales to start with, the Brothers Grimm and the many-colored books compiled by the Scotsman Lang, then the wondrous fantastical novels by Lewis Carroll, George MacDonald, and E. Nesbitt, followed by Bulfinch's retelling of Greek and Roman myths, a child's version of the Odyssey, Charlotte's Web, a book culled from the 1001 Nights and reassembled as The Seven Voyages of Sinbad the Sailor, and then, some months after that, a 600-page selection from the whole of the 1001 Nights, and the next year, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, horror and mystery stories by Poe, The Prince and the Pauper, Kidnapped, A Christmas Carol, Tom Sawyer, and A Study in Scarlet. And so strong was Ferguson's response to the book by Conan Doyle that the present he received from Aunt Mildred for his 11th birthday was an enormously fat, profusely illustrated edition of the complete Sherlock Holmes. Those were some of the books, but there were the records as well, which were no less important to Ferguson than the books, and especially now, in the past 2 or 3 years, starting when he was 9 or 10, they had been coming in at regular 3 and 4 month intervals. Jazz, classical music, folk music, rhythm and blues, and even some rock and roll. Again, as with the books, Aunt Mildred's approach was a strictly pedagogical one, and she led Ferguson along by stages, knowing that Louis Armstrong had to come before Charlie Parker, who had to come before Miles Davis, that Tchaikovsky, Ravel, and Gershwin had to precede Beethoven, Mozart, and Bach, that the Weavers had to be listened to before Leadbelly, that Ella Fitzgerald singing Cole Porter was a necessary first step before one graduated to Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit. Much to his regret, Ferguson had discovered that he possessed not one jot of talent for playing music himself. He had tried the piano at 7 and had quit in frustration a year later. He had tried the cornet at 9 and had quit. He had tried the drums at 10 and had quit. For some reason, he had trouble reading music, couldn't fully absorb the symbols on the page, the empty and filled-in circles sitting on the lines or nestled between them, the flats and sharps, the key signatures, the treble clefs and bass clefs, the notations refused to go into him and become automatically recognizable, as letters and numbers once had. And therefore, he was compelled to think about each note before he played it, which slowed his progress through the bars and measures of any given piece and, in effect, made it impossible for him to play anything. It was a sad defeat. His normally quick and efficient mind was handicapped when it came to decoding those recalcitrant marks, and rather than persist in beating his head against the wall, he had abandoned the struggle. A sad defeat, because his love of music was so strong and he could hear it so well when others played it, for his ear was sensitive and finely tuned to the subtleties of composition and performance. But he was hopeless as a musician himself, an utter washout, which meant that he was now resigned to being a listener, an ardent, devoted listener, and his Aunt Mildred was clever enough to know how to feed that devotion, which surely counted as one of the essential reasons for being alive. That summer, on one of her visits back east with Uncle Henry, Aunt Mildred helped illuminate Ferguson on another matter of great concern to him, something unrelated to books or music but equally significant to his mind, if not more so. She had come out to Montclair to spend some days with her one and only and his parents, and when the two of them sat down to lunch together on the first afternoon, his mother and father were off at work, which meant that Ferguson and his aunt were alone in the house, he pointed to the bottle of White Rock seltzer water sitting on the table and asked her why the girl had wings sprouting from her back. He couldn't understand it, he said. They weren't angel wings or bird wings, which were the kinds of wings you might expect to see on a mythological creature, but fragile insect wings, the wings of a dragonfly or a butterfly, and he found that deeply perplexing. "Don't you know who she is, Archie?" his aunt said. "No," he replied, "of course I don't. If I did know, why would I be asking the question?" "I thought you read The Bullfinch I gave you a couple of years ago." "I did." "All of it?" "I think so. I might have missed a chapter or two. I can't remember." "Never mind. You can look it up later." Lifting the bottle off the table, tapping her finger against the drawing of the girl. "It's not a very good picture, but it's supposed to be Psyche. Do you remember her now?" "Cupid and Psyche. I did read that chapter, but they never said anything about Psyche having wings. Cupid has wings, wings and a quiver of arrows. But Cupid is a god, and Psyche is just a mortal. A beautiful girl, but still a human girl, a person like us. No, wait, now I remember. After she marries Cupid, she becomes immortal too. That's right, isn't it? But I still don't understand why she has those wings." "The word Psyche means two things in Greek," his aunt said. "Two very different but interesting things. Butterfly and soul. But when you stop and think about it carefully, butterfly and soul aren't so different after all, are they? A butterfly starts out as a caterpillar, an ugly sort of earthbound, wormy nothing. And then one day the caterpillar builds a cocoon. And after a certain amount of time, the cocoon opens and out comes the butterfly, the most beautiful creature in the world. That's what happens to souls as well, Archie. They struggle in the depths of darkness and ignorance. They suffer through trials and misfortunes. And bit by bit, they become purified by those sufferings, strengthened by the hard things that happen to them. And one day, if the soul in question is a worthy soul, it will break out of its cocoon and soar through the air like a magnificent butterfly." No talent for music then, none for drawing or painting, and gruesomely inept at singing, dancing, and acting. But one thing he had a gift for was playing games, physical games. Sports and all their seasonal varieties. Baseball in the warm weather, football in the chilly weather, basketball in the cold weather. And by the time he was 12, he belonged to teams in all of those sports and was playing year-round without interruption. Ever since that late September afternoon in 1954, the never-to-be-forgotten afternoon he had spent with Cassie watching Mays and Rhodes defeat the Indians, baseball had been a core obsession, and once he began playing in earnest the next year, he proved to be surprisingly good at it, as good as the best players around him. Strong in the field, strong at bat, with an innate feel for the nuances of any given situation during the course of a game. And when a person discovers he can do something well, he tends to want to keep doing it, to do it as often as he possibly can. Countless weekend mornings, countless weekday afternoons, countless early evenings throughout the week, playing pickup games with his friends in public parks, not to mention the multiple homegrown offshoots of the game, among them stickball, wiffle ball, stoop ball, punch ball, wall ball, kickball, and roof ball, and then, at 9, Little League, and with it the chance to belong to an organized team and wear a uniform with a number on the back. Number 9, he was always number 9 for that team and all the others that followed it, 9 for the 9 players and the 9 innings, 9 as the pure numerical essence of the game itself. And on his head, the dark blue cap with the white G sewn onto the crown. G for Gallagher Sporting Goods, the sponsor of the team, which was a team with a full-time volunteer coach, Mr. Baldessari, who drilled the players in fundamentals during the weekly practice sessions and clapped his hands and shouted insults, orders, and encouragement during the twice-weekly games, one on Saturday morning or afternoon and the other on Tuesday or Thursday evening. And there was Ferguson standing at his position in the field, growing from a puny stick of a thing to a robust boy during the 4 years he spent on that team. Second baseman and number 8 hitter at 9, shortstop and number 2 hitter at 10, shortstop and cleanup hitter at 11 and 12, and the added pleasure of playing before a crowd, 50 to 100 people on average, parents and siblings of the players, assorted friends, cousins, grandparents, and stray onlookers, cheers and boos, yelling, clapping, and stomping from the bleachers that started with the first pitch thrown and lasted until the final out. And during those 4 years, his mother seldom missed a game. He would watch for her as he was warming up with his teammates, and suddenly she would be there, waving to him from her spot in the bleachers. And he could always hear her voice cutting through the others when he came up to bat. "Let's go, Archie. Nice and easy, Archie. Sock it out of here, Archie." And then, after the demise of Three Brothers Homeworld and the birth of Stanley's TV and radio, his father started coming to the games as well. And although he didn't shout in the way Ferguson's mother did, at least not forcefully enough to be heard above the crowd, he was the one who kept track of Ferguson's batting average, which rose steadily as the years advanced, ending in an absurdly high 532 for the last season, the last game of which had been played 2 weeks before Ferguson and Aunt Mildred had their conversation about psyche. But he was the best player on the team by then, one of the two or three best in the league, and that was the kind of average one expected from a top 12-year-old player. Young children didn't play basketball in the 50s because they were seen as too small, too weak to launch shots at 10-foot-high rims. So Ferguson's education in the science of hoops didn't start until the year he turned 12. But he had been playing football steadily from the age of 6, tackle football with helmets and shoulder pads, halfback mostly, since he was a determined, if not especially fast, runner. But once his hands grew large enough to grip the ball firmly, his position changed, since Ferguson and his friends discovered that he had a crazy talent for throwing passes. The spirals he flung with his right hand had more speed, more accuracy, and went much farther than anyone else's, 50, 55 yards down the field by the time he was 14. And although Ferguson didn't love the game with the same thoroughness and ardor that he loved baseball, he exulted in playing quarterback, for few sensations felt better than completing a long pass to a receiver running full tilt toward the end zone 30 or 40 yards from the line of scrimmage. The uncanny sense of an invisible connection through empty space was similar to the experience of sinking a 20-foot jump shot, but even more satisfying somehow, the connection being with another person as opposed to an inanimate object made of twine and steel. And so he endured the less appealing aspects of the sport. the rough tackles, the murderous blocks, the bruising collisions, in order to repeat the never less than thrilling sensation of throwing the ball to his teammates. Then, in November 1961, as a 14-and-a-half-year-old ninth grader, he was sacked by a 215-pound defensive lineman named Dennis Murphy and wound up in the hospital with a broken left arm. He had been planning to try out for the high school team next fall, but the problem with football was that you needed your parents' permission in order to play it, and when he came home from his first day of high school and presented the form to his mother, she refused to sign. He pleaded with her, he denounced her, he cursed her for behaving like a hysterical, overprotective mother, but Rose wouldn't budge, and that was the end of Ferguson's career as a football player. "I know you think I'm an idiot," his mother said, "but one day you'll thank me for this, Archie. You're a strong boy, but you'll never be strong enough or big enough to turn into a lummox. And that's what you have to be to play football. Thick-bodied lummox, a lunkhead who enjoys smashing other people, a human animal. Your father and I were so upset when you broke your arm last year, but now I see it as a blessing in disguise, a warning. And I'm not about to let my son crack up his body in high school so he can hobble around on a pair of damaged knees for the rest of his life. Stick to baseball, Archie. It's a beautiful sport, and you're so good at it, so exciting to watch. And why risk losing baseball by injuring yourself in a meaningless football game? If you want to go on throwing those passes of yours, play touch football. I mean, look at the Kennedys. That's what they do, isn't it? The whole family up there in Cape Cod, romping around on the lawn, flinging footballs left and right, laughing their heads off. It sure looks like a lot of fun to me. The Kennedys. Even now, as an independent, free-thinking, occasionally rebellious 15-year-old boy, he marveled at how well his mother continued to understand him, how deftly she could pierce through to his heart when the situation demanded it, his ever-blundering and conflicted heart. For even though he was unwilling to admit it to her or anyone else, he knew she was right about football, that he was temperamentally unsuited to the protocols of blood combat and would be better served by concentrating on his cherished baseball. But then she had turned the crank another notch and brought up the Kennedys, which he knew was a subject of real importance to him, far more important than the ephemeral issue of football or no football. And by deflecting the conversation from scholastic sports to the American president, the conversation had become a different conversation, and suddenly there was nothing more to be said. Ferguson had been following Kennedy for more than 2.5 years by then. Beginning with the announcement of his candidacy for the Democratic nomination on January 3, 1960, precisely 2 months before Ferguson's 13th birthday, and 3 days after the start of the new decade, which for some reason Ferguson had been looking forward to as a sign of ecstatic renewal, the whole of his conscious life having been spent in the 50s with an old man as president, the heart-attack-prone, golf-playing ex-general. And Kennedy struck him as something new and altogether remarkable, a vigorous young man out to change the world, the unjust world of racial oppression, the idiotic world of the Cold War, the perilous world of the nuclear arms race, the complacent world of mindless American materialism. And with no other candidate addressing those problems to his satisfaction, Ferguson decided Kennedy was the man of the future. He was still too young at that point to understand that politics is always politics, but at the same time, he was old enough to understand that something had to give. For those early days of 1960 were filled with news about the lunch counter sit-in staged by 4 black students in North Carolina as a protest against segregation, the disarmament conference in Geneva, the downing of the U-2 spy plane in Soviet territory, and the arrest of pilot Gary Powers, which led Khrushchev to walk out of a summit meeting in Paris and ended the Geneva disarmament talks with no progress made on halting the spread of nuclear weapons, followed by growing hostility between Castro and the United States, which cut its imports of Cuban sugar by 95%, and then, 7 days after that, on the evening of July 13th, Kennedy won the nomination on the first ballot at the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles. That was the first of 3 consecutive summers Ferguson spent at home in New Jersey, playing American Legion baseball with the Montclair Mudhens, 4 games a week as leadoff hitter and second baseman that first year, since he was the youngest player on the team now and was starting from the bottom again, the lone 13-year-old on a team of 14 and 15-year-olds. And all through those hot months of July and August, as Ferguson read newspapers and books such as Animal Farm, 1984, and Candide, listened closely to Beethoven's 3rd, 5th, and 7th symphonies for the first time, loyally kept up with each new issue of Mad Magazine, and played and replayed the Porgy and Bess album by Miles Davis, he continued to stop in at his mother's studio and his father's store for impromptu visits. And after those brief hellos, he would walk to the local Democratic Party headquarters a block and a half down the street, where he would help the adult volunteers lick stamps and envelopes in exchange for an endless supply of campaign buttons, bumper stickers, and posters, which he affixed with scotch tape to every vacant spot on the 4 walls of his bedroom, so that by the end of the summer, his room had been transformed into a shrine to Kennedy. Years later, when he was old enough to know better, he would look back on that period of youthful hero worship and cringe. But that was how things stood for him in 1960. And how could he possibly have known any better when he had been living on this earth for only 13 years? So Ferguson rooted for Kennedy to win in the same way he had once pulled for the Giants to win the World Series. For a political campaign was no different from a sporting event, he realized. Words instead of blows, perhaps, but no less rough than the bloodiest boxing match. And when it came to the office of president, the struggle was fought on a scale so grand and so spectacular that there was no better show anywhere in America. Glamorous Kennedy versus dour Nixon, King Arthur versus gloomy Gus, charm versus resentment, hope versus bitterness, day versus night. 4 times the two men squared off on television, 4 times Ferguson and his parents watched the debates in the little living room, and 4 times they were convinced that Kennedy had gotten the better of Nixon, even though people said Nixon had trumped him on the radio broadcasts. But television was all that mattered now. Television was everywhere and would soon be everything, just as Ferguson's father had predicted during the war. And the first television president had clearly won the battle on the home screen. The victory of November 8th, the narrow victory by 100,000 popular votes, one of the smallest margins in history, and the more substantial victory in the Electoral College by 84 votes. And when Ferguson went to school the next morning and celebrated with his pro-Kennedy friends, some of those figures were still not known. And talk was already circulating about why nothing had been heard from Illinois. There were rumors that Mayor Daley of Chicago had stolen voting machines from Republican districts and dumped them in Lake Michigan. And when that accusation reached Ferguson's ears, he had trouble accepting it. The idea was too reprehensible, too nauseating, for a trick like that would have turned the election into a bad joke, a travesty of devious manipulations and lies. But then, just as Ferguson was about to give full vent to his outrage, he abruptly reversed the direction of his thoughts, realizing that he had to stop with the Boy Scout stuff and admit that anything was possible. Corrupt men were everywhere, and the more powerful the man, the greater the potential for corruption. But even if the story was true, there was nothing to suggest that Kennedy had anything to do with it. Daley and his band of crooks from Cook County, perhaps. But not Kennedy. Never Kennedy. Still, in spite of his unbroken confidence in the man of the future, Ferguson spent the rest of the day walking around with an image in his head of those submerged voting machines lying at the bottom of Lake Michigan. And even after the final numbers proved that Kennedy would have won the election with or without Illinois, Ferguson continued to think about the machines, continued to think about them for years. On the morning of January 20th, 1961, he told his parents he wasn't feeling well and asked if he could stay home from school. Since Ferguson was a conscientious boy and not known for inventing imaginary ailments, his wish was granted. That was how he came to watch Kennedy's inauguration speech, sitting in front of the television set, while his mother and father worked at their jobs downtown, alone in the little living room just off the kitchen, watching the ceremony take place in the cold and blustery Washington weather, so frigid and windswept that when the ancient, roomy-eyed Robert Frost stood up to read the poem he had been asked to write for the occasion, the same Robert Frost who was responsible for the one line of poetry Ferguson knew by heart, "Two roads diverged in a yellow wood," the wind gave a fierce, sudden kick just after he arrived at the lectern, wrenching the one-page manuscript from his hands and gusting it high into the air, which left the frail, white-haired bard with nothing to read. But he pulled himself together with admirable poise and alacrity, Ferguson felt, and with his new poem flying out over the crowd, he recited an old poem from memory, turning what could have been a disaster into an odd sort of triumph. Impressive, but somehow comical as well. Or, as Ferguson put it to his parents that evening, both funny and not funny at the same time. Then came the newly sworn-in president, and the moment he began to deliver his speech, the notes emanating from that tightly strung rhetorical instrument felt so natural to Ferguson, so comfortably joined to his inner expectations, that he found himself listening to it in the same way he listened to a piece of music. "Man holds in his mortal hands. Let the word go forth. Pay any price, bear any burden. The power to abolish all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. Let every nation know. The torch has been passed. Meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe. A new generation of Americans. That uncertain balance of terror that stays the hand of mankind's final war. Now the trumpet summons us again, a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle. But let us begin. Born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, let us explore the stars. Ask, ask not. A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself. A new generation. Ask, ask not, but let us begin. For the next 20 months, Ferguson watched closely as the man of the future stumbled forward, launching his administration with the birth of the Peace Corps, and then nearly destroying it with the Bay of Pigs debacle on April 17th. 3 weeks after that, a human-sized football named Alan Shepard was punted into space by NASA, and Kennedy declared that an American would walk on the moon before the end of the 60s, which Ferguson found difficult to believe, but hoped would happen, for he wanted his man to be proven right. And then Jack and Jackie were off to Paris to meet de Gaulle, followed by 2 days of talks with Khrushchev in Vienna. And one blink of the eyes later, as Ferguson read his first book about contemporary American politics, The Making of the President, 1960, the Berlin Wall had gone up, and the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem had begun, that dolorous spectacle of the half-bald, twitching murderer sitting alone in the glass box, which Ferguson watched on television every day after school, engulfed by the horror of it and yet keeping his eyes fixed on the screen, unable to stop looking. And by the time the trial was over, he had worked his way through all 1,245 pages of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, the immense tome by blacklisted former journalist William Shirer, which won the National Book Award in 1961 and was the longest book Ferguson had ever read. The next year began with another extraterrestrial exploit. John Glenn catapulted beyond the edge of the troposphere and circling the Earth 3 times in February, which Scott Carpenter repeated in the spring, and then just 2 days after James Meredith became the first black student admitted to the University of Mississippi, another spectacle Ferguson watched on television, praying the poor man wouldn't be stoned to death, Wally Schirra outdid Glenn and Carpenter by looping around the globe 6 times in early October. Ferguson was in the 10th grade by then, his first year at Montclair High School, and because his mother had refused to sign the form in September, the football season had started without him. He was largely over that disappointment by the time of Schirra's journey, however, having found a new interest in the person of Anne-Marie Dumartin, a fellow sophomore who had come to America from Belgium 2 years earlier and was in his geometry and history classes. And so absorbed was he by this object of his rapidly growing affections that there was little time to think about the man of the future just then. And so, on the night of October 22nd, when Kennedy addressed the American people and told them about Russian missile bases in Cuba and the naval blockade he was about to put in force, Ferguson was not at home with his parents watching the broadcast. Instead, he was sitting on a bench in a public park with Anne-Marie Dumartin, wrapping his arms around her body and kissing her for the first time. For once, the normally attentive Ferguson was not paying attention. And the greatest international crisis since the end of the Second World War, the threat of nuclear conflict and the possible end of the human race, did not register with him until the following morning, after which he began paying attention again. But within a week, his man Kennedy had outmaneuvered the Russians, and the crisis was over. It had looked as if the world was about to end. And then it didn't. By Thanksgiving, there was no question in his mind that it was love. He'd lived through numerous infatuations in the past, starting with the kindergarten crushes on Kathy Gold and Margie Fitzpatrick when he was six, succeeded by a furious whirl of dalliances with Carol, Jane, Nancy, Susan, Mimi, Linda, and Connie at 12 and 13, the weekend dancing parties, the kissing sessions in moonlit backyards and basement alcoves, the first tentative advances towards sexual knowledge, the mysteries of skin and saliva-coated tongues, the taste of lipstick, the smell of perfume, the sound of nylon stockings rubbing together, and then the breakthrough at 14, the sudden jump from boyhood into adolescence, and with it a new life in an alien, ever-mutating body, unbidden erections, wet dreams, masturbation, erotic longings, nightly lust dramas performed by shadows in the sex theater now lodged in his skull, the somatic cataclysms of youth. But all those physical changes and upheavals aside, the fundamental quest, both before and after his new life began, had always been a spiritual one. The dream of an enduring connection, a reciprocal love between compatible souls, souls endowed with bodies, of course, mercifully endowed with bodies. But the soul came first, would always come first, and in spite of his flirtations with Carol, Jane, Nancy, Susan, Mimi, Linda, and Connie, he soon learned that none of those girls possessed the soul he was looking for, and one by one he had lost interest in them and allowed them to disappear from his heart. With Anne-Marie Dumartin, the story was playing itself out in reverse. The others had all begun as intense physical attractions. But the better he had come to know them, the more disenchanted he had felt. Whereas he had barely noticed Anne-Marie in the beginning, had not exchanged more than a few words with her throughout the month of September. But then their European history teacher arbitrarily paired them to work on a project together. And once Ferguson began to know her a little, he discovered that he wanted to know her more. And the more he came to know her, the higher she rose in his estimation. And after 3 weeks of daily meetings about the decline and fall of Napoleon, the subject of their joint paper, the once plain-looking Belgian girl with the slight French accent had been transformed into an exotic beauty. And Ferguson's heart was entirely filled up with her, bursting with her, and he meant to keep her there for as long as he could. A sudden, unforeseen conquest. A 15-year-old boy caught with his guard down, and then Cupid lost his way and accidentally wound up in Montclair, New Jersey. And before Psyche's husband could buy a new ticket and head back to New York or Athens or wherever he was going, he shot off an arrow for the sport of it, and thus began the agonizing adventure of Ferguson's first great love. Small, but not uncommonly small, a shade under 5'5" with no shoes on, dark, medium-length hair, round face with symmetrical features, and a sturdy, unbashful nose, full lips, slender neck, dark brows crowning gray-blue eyes, vivid eyes, illuminated eyes, slender arms and fingers, breasts fuller than might have been expected, narrow hips, thin legs, and delicate ankles. A beauty that did not declare itself at first glance, or even at second glance, but one that emerged with growing familiarity, gradually boring itself into the eye, and thereafter indelible, a face difficult to turn away from, a face to dream on. A smart and serious girl, an often somber girl, not prone to outbursts of laughter, parsimonious with her smiles, but when she did smile, her whole body turned into a knife of radiance, a gleaming sword. A newcomer, and therefore friendless, with little desire to ingratiate herself or fit in, a stubborn self-possession that appealed to Ferguson and made her different from any other girl he had known, the laughing teenage girls of northern New Jersey and all their splendid frivolity, for Anne-Marie was determined to remain an outsider, a girl uprooted from her house in Brussels, forced to live in vulgar, money-obsessed America, sticking fast to her European style of dressing, the ever-present black beret, the belted trench coat, the plaid jumpers, the white shirts with men's ties, and even though she would sometimes admit that Belgium was a dismal country, a gray and dreary patch of land wedged between the Frogs and the Huns, she would also defend it whenever she was challenged, claiming that small, almost invisible Belgium had the best beer, the best chocolate, and the best frites anywhere in the world. Early on, during one of their first meetings, before Psyche's husband had strayed into Montclair and loosed his arrow on his unsuspecting victim, Ferguson brought up the subject of the Congo and Belgium's responsibility for the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of oppressed black people. And Anne-Marie fixed her eyes on his and nodded. "You're a clever boy, Archie," she said. "You know 10 times more than any 10 of these idiot Americans put together. When I started this school last month, I decided I would stick to myself and not make any friends. Now I think I was wrong. Everyone needs a friend, and you can be that friend if you want to be." By the night of their first kiss on October 22nd, Ferguson had learned just a few scant facts about Anne-Marie's family. He knew that her father worked as an economist for the Belgian delegation to the UN, that her mother had died when Anne-Marie was 11, that her father had remarried when she was 12, and that her two older brothers, Georges and Patrice, were university students in Brussels. But that was the extent of it, along with the micro detail of her having lived in London between the ages of 7 and 9, which accounted for the fluency of her English. Before that night, however, not a single word about the stepmother, not a word about the cause of the mother's death, not a word about the father, except for the job that had brought the Dumartins to America. And because Ferguson understood that Anne-Marie was reluctant to talk about those matters, he didn't press her to open up to him. But little by little, over the weeks and months that followed, more information came out. The grisly story of her mother's cancer to begin with, cervical cancer metastasizing to levels of such pain and hopelessness that her mother ultimately killed herself with an overdose of pills, which was the official story in any case. But Anne-Marie suspected her father had started his affair with her future stepmother months before her mother's death. And who knew if the widowed Fabienne Corday, a so-called family friend of long standing, for 3 years now the second wife of Anne-Marie's blind and adoring father, the wretched woman who was now her stepmother, hadn't forced those death pills down her mother's throat in order to accelerate the transition from clandestine affair to marriage sanctified by the Catholic Church. An outrageous slander, no doubt entirely untrue, but Anne-Marie couldn't help herself. The possibility continued to eat away at her thoughts, and yet even if Fabienne was innocent, that wouldn't have made her any less despicable, any less worthy of the hatred and contempt Anne-Marie felt for her. Ferguson listened to these revelations with mounting sympathy for his beloved. Fate had wounded her, and now she was stuck inside a troubled household, at war with an odious stepmother, disappointed by a selfish, inattentive father, still mourning her dead mother, bereft at having been exiled to a harsh, unwelcoming America, angry at everything. But rather than scare Ferguson off, the operatic scale of Anne-Marie's difficulties only drew him closer to her. For now, she had been turned into a tragic figure in his eyes, a noble, suffering character, hounded by the blows of fortune. And with all the fervor of an inexperienced 15-year-old boy, his new mission in life was to rescue her from the clutches of her unhappiness. It never occurred to him that she might have been exaggerating, that the grief she felt over losing her mother had distorted her vision, that she had pushed away her stepmother without giving her a chance, turning her into an enemy for no other reason than the fact that she was not her mother and never would be, that her overworked father was doing the best he could for his enraged and obstinate daughter, that there was, as there always is, another side to the story. Adolescence feeds on drama. It is most happy when living in extremis, and Ferguson was no less vulnerable to the lure of high emotion and extravagant unreason than any other boy his age, which meant that the appeal of a girl like Anne-Marie was fueled precisely by her unhappiness, and the greater the storm she engulfed him in, the more intensely he wanted her. Arranging to be alone with her was difficult, since they were both too young to drive and had to depend on their feet for transportation, which necessarily limited the range of their movements. But one dependable recourse was the empty Ferguson house after the end of the school day. The 2 hours before his parents came home from work, when he and Anne-Marie could go upstairs to his room and shut the door. Ferguson gladly would have taken the plunge with her, but he knew Anne-Marie wasn't ready for it, and so the subject of losing the virginity was never openly discussed, which was the way such matters were handled in 1962, at least for properly raised 15-year-olds from the middle and upper middle classes of Montclair and Brussels. But if neither one of them had the courage to defy the conventions of the era, that didn't mean they neglected to make use of the bed, which fortunately was a double bed, with ample room on its surface for the two of them to stretch out side by side and take part in sex that wasn't fully sex, but which nevertheless had the taste and feel of love. Until then, it had all been about kissing, prolonged excursions of tongues wandering through the insides of mouths, wet lips, napes in the backs of ears, hands clutching faces, hands traveling through heads of hair, arms enfolding torsos, shoulders, waists, arms wrapped around other arms, and then with Connie, the previous spring, the first hesitant move to put hands on breasts, well-guarded breasts to be sure, safely covered by both blouse and bra. But he wasn't shoved or swatted away, which represented a further advance in his education, and now, with Anne-Marie, the blouse had come off, and a month after that the bra had come off, which coincided with the removal of his shirt. And even that partial nakedness was an undreamt-of pleasure that surpassed all other pleasures. And as the weeks went on, it was only by pure force of will that Ferguson restrained himself from taking hold of her hand and thrusting it onto the bulge inside his pants. Sharply remembered afternoons, not just because of what they did on that bed together, but because it all happened in broad daylight and was visible, as opposed to the blind fumbles in the dark with Connie, Linda, and the others. The sun was in the room with them, and he could see her body, their two bodies, which meant that each act of touching was also an image of that touching, and on top of that, there was a constant undercurrent of fear in the room, a dread that they would lose track of the time, and one of his parents would knock on the door while they were still embracing, or, even worse, barge into the room without remembering to knock. And while neither one of those things ever happened, there was always a chance they would, which filled those afternoon hours with a sense of urgency, danger, and outlaw daring. She was the first person he allowed into the inner chambers of his secret music palace, and when they weren't rolling around on the bed or talking about their lives, mostly Anne-Marie's life, they would listen to records on the small two-speaker machine that sat on a table in the southern corner of the room, a present from Ferguson's parents for his 12th birthday. Now, 3 years later, 1962 had become the year of J.S. Bach, the year when Ferguson listened to Bach more than any other composer, in particular Glenn Gould's Bach, with an emphasis on the preludes and fugues and the Goldberg variations, and Pablo Casals' Bach, which included endless playings of the six pieces for unaccompanied cello. and Hermann Schirschen conducting the suites for orchestra in the St. Matthew Passion, which Ferguson had concluded was the finest piece Bach had ever written, hence the finest piece ever written by anyone. But he and Anne-Marie also listened to Mozart, the Mass in C minor, Schubert, piano works performed by Sviatoslav Richter, Beethoven, symphonies, quartets, sonatas, and numerous others as well, nearly all of them gifts from Ferguson's Aunt Mildred, not to speak of Muddy Waters, Fats Waller, Bessie Smith, and John Coltrane, which was not to speak of all sorts of other 20th century souls, both living and dead. And the best thing about listening to music with Anne-Marie was watching her face, studying her eyes and looking at her mouth as tears gathered or smiles formed. How deeply she felt the emotional resonances of any given piece, for, unlike Ferguson, she had been trained since earliest childhood and could play the piano well and had an excellent soprano voice, so excellent that she broke her vow not to participate in high school activities and joined the chorus midway through the first semester. And that was perhaps their greatest bond, the need for music that ran through their bodies, which at that point in their lives was no different from the need to find a way to exist in the world. There was so much to admire about her, he felt, so much to love in her. But Ferguson never deluded himself into thinking he would be able to hold on to her, at least not past another few months or weeks or days. Right from the start, in the earliest moments of his budding infatuation, he could sense that her feelings were not as strong as his. And much as she seemed to like him, much as she seemed to enjoy his body and his record albums and his way of talking to her, he was destined to love more than he was loved in return. And within a month of their first kiss, he understood that he would have to play by her rules or else risk not being with her at all. What maddened him most was her inconsistency. How often she broke promises, how often she forgot things he said to her, how often she backed out of dates at the last minute, telling him that she wasn't feeling well, or that there was trouble at home, or that she thought they were supposed to meet on Saturday, not Friday. He sometimes wondered if there was another boy, or several boys, or a boy back in Belgium, but it was impossible to know from observation, since the first rule she demanded he adhere to was an injunction against any public displays of affection, meaning that Montclair High was off-limits, that even when they crossed paths in the classrooms, corridors, and cafeteria, they would have to pretend not to be involved with each other, that they could nod, say hello, and talk as if they were passing acquaintances, but at no time were they allowed to kiss or hold hands, which was normal conduct for every other steady couple in the school. And if that was the game she wanted to play with him, who knew if she wasn't also playing it with someone else? Ferguson felt foolish for having agreed to such an absurd bargain, but he was living under a deranged sort of enchantment just then. And the thought of losing her was far worse than the humiliation of pretending to be someone he was not. Still, they went on seeing each other, and the times they spent together always seemed to go smoothly. He always felt happiest and most fully alive when he was with her. And whatever conflicts or disagreements they had invariably seemed to take place on the telephone, that strange instrument of disembodied voices, each invisible to the other, as they talked through the wires that ran from his house to hers. And if and when he caught her at a bad moment, he often found himself listening to a cranky, pig-headed, impossible kind of person, someone altogether different from the Anne-Marie he thought he knew. The saddest, most demoralizing of these conversations came in the middle of March. After a month of tryouts for the high school baseball team, of living through the weekly postings of names on the locker room bulletin board, the anxious search for his own name on the slowly shrinking list of players who had survived the latest cut, he called to tell her that the final list had gone up and that he was one of only two sophomores who had made the varsity. A long silence on the other end of the line, which Ferguson broke by saying, "I just wanted to share the good news with you." Another pause, and then her response, delivered in a flat, cold voice. "Good news? Why should I think it's good news? I hate sports, especially baseball, which must be the dumbest game ever invented. It's empty and childish and boring, and why should a smart person like you want to waste your time running around a field with a pack of morons. Grow up, Archie. You're not a kid anymore. What Ferguson didn't know was that Anne-Marie was drunk when she said those words, as she had been several other times during their recent talks on the phone, that for some months she had been smuggling bottles of vodka into her room and drinking whenever her parents were out, long solo binges that freed the devils inside her and turned her tongue into a weapon of cruelty. The sober, well-mannered, intelligent girl of the daylight hours vanished when she was alone in her room at night, and because Ferguson never set eyes on that other person, only talked to her and listened to her angry, half-baked pronouncements, he had no idea what was going on, no idea that the first love of his life was headed for a crack-up. That last conversation took place on a Thursday, and Ferguson was so peeved and bewildered by her hostile denunciations that he was almost glad when she failed to show up at school the following morning. He needed time to think things through, he said to himself, and not having to see her that day would make it less difficult to recover from the hurt she had caused him. Struggling against the impulse to call her after school on Friday, he left the house the instant he dropped off his books and went down the block to see Bobby George, who was the other sophomore who had made the varsity team. Bulky, broad-necked Bobby, now a first-rate catcher and champion goofball, one of the morons from the pack of morons Ferguson would soon be playing with. He and Bobby wound up spending the evening with some of the other baseball morons, fellow sophomores who had made the JV team. And when Ferguson walked into his house a few minutes before midnight, it was too late to call Anne-Marie. He restrained himself on Saturday and Sunday as well, fighting off the temptation to dial her number by keeping his distance from telephones, determined not to give in, aching to give in, desperate to hear her voice again. He woke up on Monday morning fully cured, the rancor purged from his heart, prepared to forgive her for Thursday's unaccountable outburst, but then he went to school, and once again Anne-Marie was absent. He figured it was a cold or the flu. Nothing of any consequence, but now that he had granted himself the right to talk to her, he called her house at lunchtime from the payphone next to the cafeteria entrance. No answer. 10 rings and no answer. Hoping he had dialed the wrong number, he hung up the receiver and tried again. 20 rings, but no answer. He called steadily for 2 days, panic mounting with each failed attempt to get hold of her, ever more confused by what appeared to be an inexplicably empty house, a telephone that rang and rang and was never picked up. What in the world was happening, he asked himself. Where had everyone gone? And so early on Thursday morning, a good hour and a half before the first bell at school, he walked to the Dumartins' house on the other side of town, a large gabled house with an immense front lawn on one of Montclair's most elegant streets. The Street of Mansions, as Ferguson had called it when he was a small child, and even though Anne-Marie had insisted he stay away from there because she didn't want him to meet her parents, he had no choice but to go there now in order to solve the mystery of the unanswered phone, which in turn might help him solve the mystery of what had happened to her. He rang the doorbell and waited long enough to conclude that no one was at home, then rang the doorbell again, and just as he was about to turn around and leave, the door opened. A man was standing in front of him, a man who was clearly Anne-Marie's father, the same round face, the same jaw, the same gray-blue eyes. And even though it was just 7:30 in the morning, he was already fully dressed, smartly outfitted in his dark blue diplomat suit and his starched white shirt and his striped red tie, cheeks smooth from his early morning shave, a hint of cologne hovering around his head, which was a rather good-looking head, Ferguson thought, but somewhat weary around the eyes, perhaps, or else in the eyes, a fretful, distracted, melancholic sort of gaze, which Ferguson found moving somehow. No, not moving, exactly. Compelling. No doubt because this was the face that belonged to Anne-Marie's father. Yes? I'm sorry, Ferguson said. I realize it's quite early, but I'm a friend of Anne-Marie's from school, and I've been calling the house for the past few days, wanting to know if she's all right, but no one ever answers, so I got worried and walked over here to find out. And you are? Archie Ferguson. There's a simple explanation, Mr. Ferguson. The telephone has been out of order. Terrible inconvenience for all of us, but I've been assured the repairmen will be coming today. And Anne-Marie? She hasn't been well. Nothing serious, I hope. No, I'm certain everything will be fine, but for now she needs to rest. Would it be possible for me to visit her? I'm sorry. If you give me your number, I'll have her call you as soon as she's feeling a little better. Thank you. She already has the number. Good. I'll tell her to contact you. A brief pause. Just give me your name again. It seems to have slipped my mind. Ferguson. Archie Ferguson. Ferguson. That's right. And please tell Anne-Marie that I'm thinking about her. So ended Ferguson's one and only encounter with Anne-Marie's father. And as the door closed and he began walking toward the street, he wondered if Mr. Dumartin would forget his name again, or if he would simply forget to tell Anne-Marie to call him, or if he would not tell her to call him on purpose, even if he remembered his name, since that was the job of all fathers everywhere on earth, to protect their daughters from boys who were thinking about them. After that, silence, and 4 long days of nothing. Ferguson felt as if someone had tied him up and pushed him off a boat. And after sinking to the bottom of a lake, which was necessarily a large lake, no less broad and profound than Lake Michigan, he had been holding his breath underwater, 4 long days among the dead bodies and rusted voting machines, without drawing a breath. And by Sunday night, his lungs about to burst, his head about to burst, he finally found the courage to pick up the phone, and an instant later, after he dialed the Dumartin's number, there she was. So happy, she said, so glad to hear from him, sounding as if she meant it, explaining that she had called him 3 times that morning, which could have been true, since he had been out with his parents playing tennis. And then she began to tell him about the vodka, the months of secret drinking in her room, culminating in the final binge on Thursday night, the last night they had spoken to each other, which ended with her passing out on the floor. And when her father and stepmother came home from their New York dinner party at 11:30, they saw that her bedroom door was open and the light was on. So they went in and found her. And because they couldn't wake her, and because the bottle was empty, they called an ambulance to transport her to the hospital, where her stomach was pumped and she regained consciousness. But rather than send her home the next morning, they transferred her to the psychiatric ward, where she was given tests and interviewed by doctors for 3 days. And now that she'd been diagnosed as a manic depressive, in need of long-term psychotherapy, her father had decided she should return to Belgium as soon as possible, which was all she had ever wanted, a chance to escape her horrid stepmother, to put an end to her exile in horrid America, which no doubt had caused her to start drinking in the first place. And now that she would be living with her mother's sister in Brussels, her beloved Aunt Christine, which meant that she would be with her brothers and cousins and old friends again, she was feeling happy, happier than she had felt in a long, long time. He saw her only once after that, a farewell date on Wednesday, an exceptional school night outing that his mother allowed because she knew how important it was to him, even giving him extra money for cab fare, the first and only time it ever happened, so that he and his Belgian girl would not have to endure the humiliation of being chauffeured around by one of his parents, which would only have underscored how young he was, and since when had anyone that young ever been seriously in love? Yes, his mother continued to understand him, at least many of the important things about him, and he was grateful to her for that, but still, that last evening with Anne-Marie turned out to be a miserable and awkward business for Ferguson. A futile exercise in trying to maintain his dignity, reigning in his sorrow so as not to beg or cry or say something harsh to her out of bitterness or disappointment. But how not to remember throughout the evening that this was the end, the last time he would ever see her? And to make matters worse, she was at her very best that night, so warm, so effusive in what she said about him. My wonderful Archie, my beautiful Archie, my brilliant Archie. Each kind word seemed to be describing someone who wasn't there, a dead person. They were the words that belonged in a funeral oration. And even worse than that was her unaccustomed cheerfulness, the joy he could see in her eyes when she talked about going away, not once stopping to think that going away meant leaving him behind the day after tomorrow. But suddenly she was laughing and telling him not to worry. They would see each other again soon. He could come to Brussels and spend the summer with her, as if his parents could afford to fly him to Europe, they who had not once gone to California to visit Aunt Mildred and Uncle Henry in all the years they had been there. And then she was saying something even more incomprehensible and wounding to him, sitting on the bench in the park where they had first kissed in October and were now kissing again on their last night together in March, saying that maybe it was a lucky thing for him that she was going, that she was so messed up and he was so normal, and he deserved to be with a healthy, normal girl, not a sick, crazy girl like her. And from that moment until he dropped her off at her house 20 minutes later, he felt as sad as he had ever been in his whole disgustingly normal life. A week later, he wrote her a 9-page letter and sent it to her aunt's address in Brussels. A week after that, a 6-page letter. 3 weeks after that, a 2-page letter. A month after that, a postcard. She didn't answer any of them, and by the time school let out for the summer, he understood that he was never going to write to her again. The truth was that healthy, normal girls didn't interest him. Life in the suburbs was dull enough, and the problem with healthy, normal girls was that they reminded him of the suburbs, which had become far too predictable for his taste, and the last thing he wanted was to be with a predictable girl. Whatever her shortcomings, whatever anguish she had caused him, at least Anne-Marie had been full of surprises. At least she had kept his heart pounding in a state of prolonged suspense. And now that she was gone, everything had become dull and predictable again, even more oppressive than it had been before she walked into his life. He knew it wasn't her fault, but he couldn't help feeling betrayed. She had abandoned him, and from now on it was either make do with the morons or live in solitary confinement for the next 2 years, at which point he would flee this place and never come back. He was 16 now, and he spent the summer working for his father and playing baseball in the evenings. Always baseball. Still and always baseball. Which was no doubt a mindless pursuit, but continued to give too much pleasure for him to think of abandoning it. This time in a league for high school and college players from around the country. A stiff and competitive league. But he had done well in his first year on the Montclair varsity, starting third baseman and number 5 hitter, a .312 batting average for a good team, the best team in the Big Ten Conference. And he was hitting for more power now as he continued to grow. 5'11 at the last measurement, 174 pounds the last time he stepped on the scales. And so he played that summer in order to keep his hand in, and spent the mornings and afternoons working for his father, mostly driving around town in the van, delivering and installing air conditioners with a guy named Ed. And when there was nothing to deliver, he would help Mike Antonelli up front with sales or fill in for Mike while he took one of his frequent coffee breaks at Al's Diner. And when there were no customers in the store, he would go into the back room and sit with his father until someone else showed up, his almost 50-year-old father, still lean and fit, still anchored to his work table and repairing broken machines, his walled-off and silent father, almost serene now after 6 years in the quiet of that back room. And while Ferguson consistently offered to help with the repair work, even though he was clumsy and unskilled in all that pertained to machines, his father always shrugged him off, saying his son shouldn't be wasting his time on broken toasters. He was traveling a road that would lead to far greater things than that. And if he wanted to make himself useful, he should bring in some of those poetry books he had at home and read out loud while his old man took care of the broken toasters. And so it was that Ferguson, who had been ingesting vast amounts of poetry in the past year and a half, spent a portion of that summer reading to his father in the back room of Stanley's TV and radio. Dickinson, Hopkins, Poe, Whitman, Frost, Eliot, Cummings, Pound, Stevens, Williams, and others. But the poem his father seemed to like best, the one that seemed to make the strongest impression on him, was the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which startled Ferguson and because he was unprepared for that reaction, he understood that he had missed something, had been missing something for a long time now, which meant that he would have to rethink everything he had previously assumed about his father. For once he had finished the last line, "Till human voices wake us, and we drown," his father turned to him and looked into his eyes, looked at him with an intensity Ferguson had never seen in all the years he had known him, and after a long pause he said, "Oh, Archie, what a magnificent thing. Thank you. Thank you so much." And then his father shook his head back and forth 3 times and spoke the last words again, "Till human voices wake us and we drown." The last week of summer, August 28th, and the March on Washington, the speeches at the mall, the immense crowds, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and then the speech that school children would later have to memorize, the speech of speeches, as important on that day as the Gettysburg Address had been on its day. A big American moment, a public moment for all to see and hear, even more essential than the words spoken at Kennedy's inauguration 32 months earlier. And everyone at Stanley's TV and radio stood in the front room and watched the broadcast. Ferguson and his father, big-bellied Mike and shrimpy Ed. And then Ferguson's mother came in as well, along with 5 or 6 pedestrians who happened to be walking by. But before the big speech, there were several other speeches. Among them, an address delivered by a local New Jersey man, Rabbi Joachim Prince, the most admired Jew in Ferguson's part of the world, a hero to his parents, even if they did not practice their religion or belong to a synagogue. But all 3 Fergusons had seen him and heard him talk at weddings, funerals, and bar mitzvahs at the temple he presided over in Newark, the famous Joachim Prince, who as a young rabbi in Berlin had denounced Hitler even before the Nazis took power in 1933. Who saw the future more clearly than anyone else and urged Jews to quit Germany, which led to repeated arrests by the Gestapo and his own expulsion in 1937. And of course, he was active in the American civil rights movement, and of course he had been chosen to represent the Jews that day because of his eloquence and well-documented courage. And of course, Ferguson's parents were proud of him, they who had shaken his hand and talked to him. The person who was now standing before the camera and addressing the nation, the entire world, and then King stepped to the podium. And 30 or 40 seconds after the speech began, Ferguson looked over at his mother and saw that her eyes were glistening with tears, which amused him greatly. Not because he felt it was inappropriate for her to respond in that way, but precisely because he didn't. Because this was yet one more instance of how she engaged with the world. Her excessive, often sentimental reading of events, the gushes of feeling that made her so susceptible to tearing up at bad Hollywood movies, the good-hearted optimism that sometimes led to muddled thinking and crushing disappointment. And then he looked over at his father, a man almost entirely indifferent to politics, who seemed to demand so much less from life than his mother did. And what he saw in his father's eyes was a combination of vague curiosity and boredom. The same man who had been so moved by the dreary resignation of Eliot's poem was having a hard time swallowing the hopeful idealism of Martin Luther King. And as Ferguson listened to the mounting emotion in the minister's voice, the drum roll repetitions of the word dream, he wondered how 2 such oddly matched souls could have married and stayed married for so many years, and how he himself could have been born from such a couple as Rose Adler and Stanley Ferguson, and how strange, how deeply strange it was to be alive. On Labor Day, about 20 people came to the house for an end-of-summer barbecue. His parents rarely organized such large gatherings. But 2 weeks earlier, his mother had won a photography competition sponsored by the governor's new arts council in Trenton. The award came with a commission to produce a book of portraits of 100, quote, outstanding New Jersey citizens, unquote. A project that would be sending her around the state to photograph mayors, college presidents, scientists, businessmen, artists, writers, musicians, and athletes. And because the job would be well paid, and Ferguson's parents were feeling flush for the first time in several years, they decided to celebrate with a grilled meat blowout in the backyard. The usual crowd was there, the Solomons, the Brownsteins, the Georges from down the block, Ferguson's grandparents, and his great-aunt Pearl. But some other people turned up as well, among them a family from New York called the Schneidermans, which consisted of a 45-year-old commercial artist named Daniel, the younger son of Ferguson's mother's old boss, Emmanuel Schneiderman, who was now living in a retirement home in the Bronx, and Daniel's wife, Liz, and their 16-year-old daughter, Amy. On the morning of the Labor Day fete, as Ferguson and his parents chopped vegetables and prepared barbecue sauce in the kitchen, his mother told him that he and Amy had known each other as small children and had played together a few times. But somehow she had fallen out of touch with the Schneidermans. 12 years had fluttered off the calendar. And then, just a couple of weeks ago, on a visit to see her parents in New York, she had bumped into Dan and Liz on Central Park South. Hence the invitation. Hence the Schneidermans' first ever visit to Montclair. His mother continued, "From the look in your eyes, Archie, I gather you've forgotten about Amy. But back when you were 3 and 4, you had quite a crush on her. Once, when we all went to the Schneidermans' apartment for a late afternoon Sunday dinner, you and Amy went into her room, closed the door, and took off all your clothes. You can't even remember that, can you? The adults were still sitting around the table, but then we heard you giggling in there, shrieking with laughter, making those wild, out-of-control sounds only little children can make. And so we all got up to see what the commotion was about. Dan opened the door, and there you were, the two of you, just 3 and a half or 4 years old, jumping up and down on the bed, stark naked, shrieking your heads off like a pair of crazy people. Liz was mortified, but I found it hilarious. That ecstatic look on your face, Archie, the sight of your two little bodies bouncing up and down, the savage joy filling the room, nutty human children acting like chimpanzees, it was impossible not to burst out laughing. Your father and Daniel both laughed too, I remember, but Liz charged into the room and ordered you and Amy to get dressed. At once. You know that angry mother's voice. At once. But before you could get your clothes on, Amy said one of the funniest things I've ever heard. Mommy, she asked, all serious now and very thoughtful, pointing her finger directly at your privates, and then at her own, Mommy, why is Archie so fancy and I'm so plain? Ferguson's mother laughed hard and long at the memory of those words. But Ferguson only smiled, a weak excuse of a smile that quickly vanished from his face. For few things gave him less pleasure than hearing about the idiotic shenanigans of his early childhood. He said to his still-laughing mother, "You like to tease me, don't you?" "Only sometimes," she said. "Not so often, Archie. But sometimes I just can't resist." An hour later, Ferguson went out into the yard with his book of the moment, Journey to the End of the Night, and sat down in one of the Adirondack chairs he and his father had repainted earlier in the summer. Dark green, dark, dark green. But rather than open the book and learn more about Ferdinand's adventures at the Ford Motor Plant in Detroit, he just sat there and thought as he waited for the first guests to arrive, marveling at the fact that he had once romped on a bed with a naked girl, had once been naked himself as he romped with a naked girl, and how perfectly comical it was that he should have no memory of having done that, whereas now he would give almost anything to be with a naked girl. To be naked in bed with a naked girl was the single most important aspiration of his lonely, loveless life. Not one kiss or embrace in more than 5 months, he said to himself, a full spring, and almost an entire summer of mourning for the absent, half-naked Anne-Marie Dumartin. And now he was about to meet the unremembered naked girl from his distant past, Amy Schneiderman, who no doubt had developed into a normal, healthy girl, boring and predictable, as most girls were, as most boys were, as most men and women were, but that couldn't be helped. And given that he hadn't even met her yet, he would just have to see what he would see. What he saw that afternoon was the person who became the next one, the successor to the crown of his desires. A girl who was neither normal nor not normal, but burning, unafraid, aware of the exceptional self she had been born with. And some weeks after their first encounter, as summer dissolved into autumn and the world around them suddenly turned dark, she became the first one as well, meaning that naked Amy Schneiderman and naked Archie Ferguson were no longer jumping on the bed, but lying in the bed, brawling around under the covers. And for years after that, she would continue to bring him the greatest joys and the greatest torments of his young life, to be the indispensable other who dwelled inside his skin. But back to that Monday afternoon in September 1963, the Labor Day barbecue in the Fergusons' backyard, and the first glimpse he had of her as she stepped out of her parents' blue Chevrolet, the head of dirty blonde hair emerging from the back seat, and then the surprising fact of how tall she was, at least 5'8", perhaps 5'9", a big girl with an impressively handsome face. Not pretty or beautiful, but handsome. Solid nose, forthright chin, large eyes of still undetermined color, neither heavy nor slight of build, smallish breasts under a blue short-sleeved blouse, long legs, round ass encased in a pair of tight-fitting tan slacks, and an odd sort of galumphing walk, torso pitched forward ever so slightly, as if impatient to be barreling forward. A tomboy's walk, he supposed, but fetching and unusual, signaling that she was someone to be reckoned with, a girl different from most 16-year-old girls because she carried herself without the slightest trace of self-consciousness. His mother presided over the introductions, a handshake with the mother, slightly tense, a brief smile, a handshake with the father, relaxed, amiable. And even before he shook hands with Amy, he could sense that Liz Schneiderman didn't like his mother because she suspected her husband was half in love with her, which might have been true, considering the protracted hug of greeting Schneiderman gave the still beautiful 41-year-old Rose. And then Ferguson was shaking Amy's hand, her long and remarkably slender hand, determining that her eyes were dark green with some flecks of brown in them, observing when she smiled that her teeth were a bit too big for her mouth, a fraction too big, and therefore arresting. And then he heard her voice for the first time, "Hello, Archie." And at that moment he knew beyond any doubt, that they were destined to be friends, which was a ridiculous assumption to make, of course, since how could he have known anything at that point? But there it was, a feeling, an intuition, a certainty that something important was happening, and that he and Amy Schneiderman were about to set off on a long journey together. Bobby George was there that day, along with his brother Carl, who was about to begin his sophomore year at Dartmouth, but Ferguson had no desire to talk to either one of them, not to the swift-thinking Carl, nor to the bird-brained, ever-joking Bobby. What he wanted was to be with Amy, the only other young person at the party. And so within 45 seconds of shaking her hand, as a strategy to avoid having to share her with the others, he invited her up to his room. It was a somewhat impetuous thing to do, perhaps, but she accepted with a willing nod of the head, saying, "Good idea, let's go." And up they went to Ferguson's second-floor refuge, which was no longer a shrine to Kennedy, but a place crammed with books and records. So many books and records that the overcrowded shelves could no longer contain the collection, which was continuing to grow in piles stacked up against the wall nearest to the bed. And it pleased him to watch Amy nod again as she entered the room, as if telling him that she approved of what she saw, the scores of sanctified names and hallowed works, which he then proceeded to examine more closely, pointing to this one and saying, "A hell of a good book," pointing to that one and saying, "I still haven't read it," pointing to a third and saying, "Never heard of him." But before long, she sat down on the floor at the foot of the bed, which prompted Ferguson to sit down on the floor as well, face to face with her from a distance of 3 feet, leaning his back against the drawers of his desk. And for the next hour and a half, they talked, stopping only when someone knocked on the door and announced that food was being served in the backyard, which propelled them downstairs to join the others for a while as they ate hamburgers and drank forbidden beer in front of their parents, all four of whom failed to blink at this flouting of the law. And then Amy reached into her bag, pulled out a pack of Luckies and lit up in front of her parents, who again failed to blink, explaining that she didn't smoke much, but loved the taste of tobacco after a meal. And once the meal and the cigarette had been taken care of, Ferguson and Amy excused themselves and took a slow walk around the neighborhood as the sun began to go down, eventually landing on a bench in the same small park where he had kissed Anne-Marie for the last time before she disappeared. And not long after Ferguson and Amy arranged to see each other again in New York on the Saturday after next, they too began to kiss. An unplanned, spontaneous leap as one mouth latched onto the other, a delicious slobber of flailing tongues and clanking teeth, instant arousal in the rambunctious nether zones of their post-pubescent bodies, kissing with such abandon that they might have eaten each other up if Amy hadn't suddenly pulled away from him and started to laugh, a spurt of breathless, astonished laughter that soon had Ferguson laughing as well. "Good grief, Archie," she said. "If we don't stop now, we'll be ripping off our clothes in a couple of minutes." She stood up and extended her right arm to him. "Come on, crazy man. Let's go back to the house." They were the same age, or very nearly the same age, 200 months old as opposed to 198 months old. But because Amy had been born at the end of 1946, December 29th, and Ferguson at the beginning of 1947, March 3rd, she was a full year ahead of him in school, which meant that she was about to start her senior year at Hunter, while he was still stuck in the trenches as a lonely junior. College was no more than a nebulous anywhere to him at that point, a far-flung destination that had yet to be given a name. Whereas she had been studying maps for the better part of a year and was almost ready to begin packing her bags. She would be applying to several schools, she said. Everyone had told her she would need backup, second and third options, but Barnard was her first choice, her only choice really, because it was the best college in New York, the all-girl twin of all-boy Columbia, and objective number one was to stay in New York. "But you've been in New York all your life," Ferguson said. "Wouldn't you like to try some other place?" "I've been to other places," she said, "lots of other places, and every one of them is called Yuan City. Have you ever been to Boston or Chicago?" "No." "Yuan City 1 and Yuan City 2. L.A.? "No." "Yuan City 3. "Fine, but what about a school in the country? Cornell, Smith, one of those places. Green lawns and echoing quads, the pursuit of knowledge in a rustic setting." "Joseph Cornell is a genius. The Smith brothers make excellent cough drops, but freezing my ass off for 4 years at Wilderness U isn't my idea of a fun time. No, Archie, New York is it. There's no other place." He'd known her for approximately 10 minutes when they exchanged these words. And as Ferguson listened to Amy defend New York, declare her love of New York, it occurred to him that she herself was somehow an embodiment of her city, not only in her confidence and quickness of mind, but also and especially in her voice, which was the voice of brainy Jewish girls from Brooklyn, Queens, and the Upper West Side, the third-generation New York Jewish voice, meaning the second generation of Jews born in America, which had a slightly different music from the New York Irish voice, for example, or the New York Italian voice, at once earthy, sophisticated, and brash, with a similar aversion to hard R's, but more precise and emphatic in its articulations. And the more he accustomed himself to those articulations, the more he wanted to go on hearing them. For the Schneiderman voice represented everything that was not the suburbs, not his life as it existed now, and therefore the promise of an escape into a possible future, or at least the present inhabited by that possible future. And as he sat in the room with Amy, and later walked through the streets with her, they talked about any number of things, mostly about the roller coaster summer that had started with the killing of Medgar Evers and ended with Martin Luther King's speech, the endless tangle of horror and hope that seemed to define the American landscape, and also about the books and records on the shelves and floor of Ferguson's room, not to mention schoolwork, SATs, and even baseball. But the one question he did not ask her was determined at all costs to refrain from asking, was whether she had a boyfriend, for he had already decided he was going to do everything in his power to make her the next one, and he had no interest in learning how many rivals were standing in his way. On September 7th, less than a week after the Labor Day barbecue, which was exactly 1 week before they were supposed to get together again in New York, she called him, and because he was the one she called and no one else, he understood that there was no boyfriend in the picture, no rival to be afraid of, and that she was with him now in the same way he was with her. He knew that because he was the person she chose to call when she heard the news about the bombing of a black church in Birmingham, Alabama, and the murder of four little girls inside. Another American horror, another battle in the race war spreading across the South, as if the March on Washington 2 weeks earlier had to be avenged with bombs and murder. And Amy was crying into the phone, struggling not to cry, as she told him the news, and bit by bit, as she slowly pulled herself together, she began to talk about what could be done, about what she felt had to be done, not just laws passed by politicians, but an army of people to go down there and fight the bigots, and she would be the first one to join up. The day after she graduated from high school, she would hitchhike to Alabama and work for the cause, bleed for the cause, make the cause the central purpose of her life. "It's our country," she said, "and we can't let the bastards steal it from us." They saw each other the following Saturday and every other Saturday throughout the fall, Ferguson riding the bus from New Jersey to the Port Authority terminal and then taking the IRT express train to West 72nd Street, where he could get off and walk 3 blocks north and 2 blocks west to the Schneiderman's apartment on Riverside Drive and 75th Street, apartment 4B, which was now the most important address in New York City. Outings of various sorts, nearly always just the two of them together, occasionally with some of Amy's friends, foreign films at the Thalia on Broadway and 95th Street, Godard, Kurosawa, Fellini, visits to the Met, the Frick, the Museum of Modern Art, the Nix at the Garden, Bach at Carnegie Hall, Beckett, Pinter, and Ionesco at small theaters in the Village. Everything so close and available, and Amy always knew where to go and what to do. The warrior princess of Manhattan was teaching him how to find his way around her city, which had rapidly become his city as well. Nevertheless, for all the things they did and all the things they saw, the best part of those Saturdays was sitting in coffee shops and talking, the first rounds of the ongoing dialogue that would continue for years, conversations that sometimes turned into fierce spats when their opinions differed, the good or bad film they had just seen, the good or bad political idea one of them had just expressed. But Ferguson didn't mind arguing with her. He had no interest in pushovers, the pouting, nincompoop girls who wanted only what they imagined to be the formalities of love. This was real love, complex and deep and pliable enough to allow for passionate discord. And how could he not love this girl, with her relentless, probing gaze and immense, booming laugh, the high-strung and fearless Amy Schneiderman, who one day was going to be a war correspondent, or a revolutionary, or a doctor who worked among the poor. She was 16 years old, pushing toward 17. The blank slate was no longer entirely blank, but she was still young enough to know she could rub out the words she had already written, rub them out, and start again, whenever the spirit moved her. Kisses, of course, embraces, of course, along with the irksome fact that Amy's parents tended to stay at home on Saturday afternoons and evenings, which limited the opportunities for being alone in the apartment and led to much chilly weather necking on benches in Riverside Park, some furtive back bedroom make-out splurges at parties given by Amy's friends, and twice, just twice, on the two occasions when her homebody parents stepped out for the evening, a chance to indulge in earnest half-naked tumbles on the bed in Amy's room, marked by the old fear that the door would be flung open at the worst possible moment. The frustrations of not being fully in control of their lives, hormonal frenzies thwarted again and again by circumstances, the two of them growing ever more desperate as the weeks passed. Then, on a Tuesday night in mid-November, Amy called with good news. Her parents would be going out of town the weekend after next, 3 full days in distant Chicago, to visit her mother's ailing mother, and with her big brother Jim not scheduled to fly in from Boston until the day before Thanksgiving, she would have the apartment to herself while her parents were gone. A whole weekend, she said. Just think of it, Archie, a whole weekend with no one in the apartment but us. He told his parents that he and a couple of his friends had been invited to another friend's house on the Jersey Shore, a lie so ornate and nonsensical that neither one of them saw through it. And when he left for school on the Friday in question, it seemed altogether appropriate that he should be carrying a small overnight bag with him. The plan was to leave for New York the instant school let out, and if he was lucky enough to catch the first bus, he would be at Amy's apartment by 4:30 or 4:45, and if he missed the first bus and had to take the second, by 5:30 or 5:45. Another dull day in the corridors and classrooms of Montclair High School, concentrating on the clock, as if he could will time forward by the sheer power of his thoughts, counting the minutes, counting the hours, and then, in the early afternoon, the announcement over the public address system that the president had been shot in Dallas, followed by another announcement sometime later that President Kennedy was dead. Within minutes, all activities at the school came to a halt. Handkerchiefs and tissues appeared in 1,000 pairs of hands. Mascara was running down the cheeks of sobbing girls. Boys walked around shaking their heads or punching the air with their fists. Girls were hugging. Boys and girls were hugging. Teachers were sobbing and hugging while others looked blankly at walls and doorknobs. And before long, students were massing in the gym and cafeteria. No one had any idea what to do. No one was in charge. All feuds and animosities had stopped. There were no enemies anymore. And then the principal's voice came over the public address system again and announced that school was dismissed, that everyone could go home. The man of the future was dead. Unreal City. Everyone was going home, but Ferguson was carrying his overnight bag and walking to the Montclair bus stop to wait for the New York bus. He would call his parents later, but he wasn't going home. He needed to be by himself for a while, and then he needed to be with Amy, and he would stay with her as planned throughout the weekend. Two roads diverged in an unreal city, and the future was dead. Waiting for the bus, then mounting the steps of the bus and looking for a seat, sitting down in the fifth row and then listening to the gears shift as the bus pulled away and headed for New York. Then riding through the tunnel as a woman sobbed in the seat behind him and the driver talked to a passenger up front. I can't believe it. I can't fucking believe it. But Ferguson believed it, even though he felt entirely removed from himself, floating somewhere just outside his body, but at the same time clear in his head, altogether lucid, with no inclination to break down and cry. No, all this was too big for that. Let the woman behind him sob her heart out. It probably made her feel better. But he would never feel better, and therefore he didn't have the right to cry. He only had the right to think, to try to understand what was happening. This big thing that resembled nothing else that had ever happened to him. The man talking to the driver said, "It reminds me of Pearl Harbor. You know, everything all calm and quiet. A lazy Sunday morning. People hanging around the house in their pajamas, and then, bang, the world explodes, and suddenly we're at war." Not a bad comparison, Ferguson thought. The big event that rips through the heart of things and changes life for everyone. The unforgettable moment when something ends and something else begins. Was that what this was, he asked himself, a moment similar to the outbreak of war? No, not quite. War announces the beginning of a new reality, but nothing had begun today. A reality had ended, that was all. Something had been subtracted from the world, and now there was a hole, a nothing where there had once been a something. As if every tree in the world had vanished, as if the very concept of tree or mountain or moon had been erased from the human mind. A sky without a moon. A world without trees. The bus pulled into the terminal at 40th Street and 8th Avenue. Rather than walk through the underground passageways to 7th Avenue as he normally did on his trips to New York, Ferguson climbed the stairs and went out into the late November twilight. walking east along 42nd Street as he headed toward his subway stop at Times Square. One more body in the early rush hour crowd, the dead faces of people going about their business. Everything the same, everything different. Then he found himself pushing his way through clusters of motionless pedestrians gathered on the pavement, all of them looking up at the stream of illuminated type circling the tall building in front of them. JFK shot and killed in Dallas, Johnson sworn in as president. And just before he reached the steps that would take him down to the IRT subway platform, he heard a woman say to another woman, "I can't believe it, Dorothy. I just can't believe what my eyes are seeing." Unreal. A city without trees. A world without trees. He hadn't called Amy to find out if she had come home from school. It was possible that she was still with her friends, swept up in the confusion of the moment, overwrought, too shaken to have remembered that he was coming. And so, when he pushed the buzzer of apartment 4B, it was unclear to him whether anyone would answer. 5 seconds of doubt, 10 seconds of doubt. Then he heard her voice talking to him through the intercom. "Archie, is that you, Archie?" And a moment later, she buzzed him in. They spent several hours watching the coverage of the assassination on TV. And then, with their arms wrapped around each other in a tight embrace, they stumbled into Amy's room, lowered themselves onto the bed, and made love for the first time.